Morning, Council.
Chief Justice Steele, members of the court, William Caddy for the appellant, Rhineco, Inc., in this case. This is an interlocutory appeal which the court granted from a new trial given by the trial court to the plaintiff after the jury had found in favor of Rhineco in personal injury litigation. The judge gave three reasons. One, that the evidence concerning comparative negligence came into the case and she took comparative negligence away from the jury before it began deliberations. That evidence plus other evidence caused confusion to the jury, and that she inappropriately allowed defendant's expert, Mr. Clauser, to go beyond the scope of his expert report, which caused surprise to the plaintiff in being able to cross-examine him.
Before you get into the discussion of those three bases and make your major point, something that I can't get clear from the briefs. When did the trial judge make her decision to remove the issue of comparative negligence from the jury? There's a reference in the brief that it was before trial, which really confused me. Was it at the end of the plaintiff's case, or?
It was before we made the arguments, before she did instructions, after all the evidence was in.
Oh, okay, so it's at the conclusion of the defense case.
Right. I had made a reference in my reply brief that was just an error in the plaintiff's answering brief, and gave the page citation where it had been done by the trial judge. It was at the conclusion of all the evidence. It was after I had moved for certain directed verdicts myself, and then the plaintiff moved, I believe, for two directed
verdicts. So what was the jury told about comparative negligence in the instructions?
I believe that the jury was just informed that the comparative negligence issue was not for them to decide. It had been removed from their consideration. So they knew going into the deliberations that they were deciding, was Rhineco negligent? And if Rhineco was negligent, what would be the damages that they would award to Mr. Thompson? You may note that we put on no evidence regarding damages. We tried this case solely as a liability case. And a few of the facts in the case that we believed were important. One, the machine was 28 years old, and this particular pipe, as far as we were able to determine, was the original pipe that had been on the machine when it was assembled back in 1971. And the other point, which became, as I was trying the case, important, was that this particular hydrous heater was going to go out of service the next day. Mark Thompson was going to take possession from Martom of a new, bigger, improved version the following day.
And I have another question about the record. And is there anything in the record that the trial judge relied on to determine the jury was confused? And normally when we look at jury confusion, it's related to one or more notes from the juries or things like that. And in this case, I didn't see any reference to any notes or other indication that the jury was confused.
Our position is that the jury was not confused. There was no external evidence, either in notes or the way the jury questionnaire at the end of the verdict was filled out, or anything to give that impression. It's our opinion that the judge felt that the trial had gone in kind of a broken up fashion, because we were relying upon several depositions that had been taken during the discovery phase when the mulch defendants were still in the case, and a lot of the questioning that we were using was mulch defendant questions.
So the way I understand your argument, the jury was asked first, was your client negligent? And they said no.
That's correct.
And your position is that in deciding that question, they were properly and only focused on the negligence of your client, and they found none, and that to the extent there could have been any confusion about contributory negligence and whether the taking it out of the case was adequately instructed to the jury, and that really couldn't be a consideration because they never got to that issue. They only would have gotten to the issue that the judge attributed to confusion if they found your client was negligent.
That's exactly our argument.
And I take it there was a specific block of instructions to the jury on the issue of your client's negligence.
Yes, there was. And the And they focused upon the decisions made back when this machine was designed, starting in the 50s, up until the time that this particular machine was assembled in 1971 and sent to the first purchaser. Marcom was the second purchaser. They bought it, I believe it was in 1991, so they had it for 8 years. So our position, I believe it was the Lange decision by this court about a year or so ago, which indicated that when there was a problem with damage arguments by counsel, that the fact that the jury decided never reached the issue of damages by finding for the defendant meant that it really couldn't have been confusion. What the judge was focusing on were issues of comparative negligence, or we were arguing superseding intervening cause by the employer in this particular case. And because the jury answered just the first question, we did not have the problem that popped up in a number of cases, including DuPhilly, the first DuPhilly case, where they answered the questions and the answers became illogical because of the way they had been answered. We start with certain premises in that circumstances. One, that the jury is presumed to follow the instructions they get, which comes from the Middlebrook case, which is a criminal case, but would still apply.
Did the closing arguments also follow the pattern of this is the interrogatory, here's what you do, this is the issue you could consider and move on?
My argument pretty much followed. I don't think I read the questions or anything in that nature in my closing argument. I sort of followed the same pattern. It was an old machine. We didn't do anything wrong when we designed it. We didn't do anything wrong when we manufactured it, and then dealt with the experts, and then dealt with the issue of the employer's superseding intervening cause, which ties into the third position by the trial judge, that she inappropriately let Mr. Clouser go beyond the scope of his report, which somehow caused confusion, which maybe somehow went back, I guess, in her thinking to the answer to the original question.
Well, let me ask a question a little more bluntly. This isn't one of those rare cases where we hear that the record supports the argument that despite the trial court's ruling that comparative negligence was out of the case or contributory negligence on the part of the plaintiff was out of the case, that counsel for the defense nevertheless argued it anyway. That's not an issue.
I did not. Once the judge made a ruling at the close of all the evidence, the issue was never raised.
There was nothing in that argument that could have confused the jury about their role in deciding whether Renko was negligent or not.
No. The plaintiff's argument, as I understand it, is that the judge was there. She had an opportunity to observe what was happening as the evidence came in. If she was feeling it was getting confusing, that somehow was her ability to sort of determine from the jury that they must have been confused if she felt the evidence was coming in a confused fashion.
Well, that goes to the standard that we apply to the trial judge's order granting the motion for a new trial, correct?
Yes.
What's your view of how we approach
it? It's supposed to be sound judicial reasoning in determining whether or not discretion was properly applied. I think that's the story. It's a little longer, but you're looking to see if the reasoning was sound. And our position is that if you look at the evidence, that in reality comparative negligence should have gone to the jury. We look at Mr. Clouser's opinions that they're disputed, but they're not contentious. He said that there had to be a blow of 250 pounds of force, 42 inches above the deck, in order to cause the pipe, even though it was weakened by corrosion, to break. The only person that was up on top of the deck at the time the pipe failed was the plaintiff. So either there's two circumstances. One, the plaintiff accidentally hit the pipe, such as he fell or he slipped and grabbed at the pipe or hit the pipe to give it enough force, or he was doing something purposefully, such as trying to get the pipe to work or the hose to work or get a clog. And that's why a lot of the clog testimony came in that the judge is focused
on. Well, we know that the trial judge didn't buy that. But my question is, at what stage do we conclude that the gut feelings of the trial judge about how the trial went trumps the clarity of the interrogatories given to the jury and a lack of confusion in the written answer that the jury gives to those special interrogatories.
Well, Justice Quillen's written on that twice, once as when he was on this bench and then once at the trial bench in the Ellis case. And as I read his opinion in the Ellis case is that this court has to be careful of what the trial court judges are doing because of the great deference that's given in, by the standard for judicial discretion, that there's a danger or a worry that the trial judge merely is starting to substitute his or her opinion of how the evidence was, rather than doing the great deference in this state to the jury's determination of the findings of fact.
So let's put aside the comparative negligence. In the Delaware Constitution, it talks about the findings of fact, if supported by the evidence, shall be conclusive. So on appeal.
On appeal.
So what we're focusing on in this case is whether or not, based on the evidence, the jury could find no negligence on behalf of your client.
It gets to be confusing when you try to think it through because the trial judge is not bound by that constitutional provision. This court is bound by that provision. The trial judge is permitted to, on a motion for new trial, to view the evidence. And it's never clearly expressed. It's expressed in one fashion as the verdict has to be against at least the great weight of the evidence. But elsewhere in the Story decision, it seems to start to talk about the trial judge can make determinations of credibility and weigh the evidence. But it'd be our position that it would only, a new trial obviously has to meet the standard that the jury's verdict is at least against the great weight of the evidence. But I would suggest it's almost even, it should be maybe expressed as the trial judge should accept the findings of fact by the jury as long as any reasonable jury could have come up with that verdict.
Was there a motion for a directed verdict against your client and in favor of the plaintiff?
Yes, there was.
And what did the trial judge say?
She said she would submit the issue to the jury.
Did she say why?
I'd have to read that part of the...
Presumably because there was sufficient evidence to do so.
That there were issues raised as to whether or not we were negligent back when we designed and manufactured the machine. And that came out mostly from the contest between the experts.
And she clearly understood her role because she did grant a directed verdict on the issue of comparative negligence.
Yes, she did. She felt that I had not produced enough evidence, either directly or by inference, that that issue should go to the jury.
Could we focus on that for a moment? Am I correct that the comparative negligence issue related to removing clogs in the pipe?
It related to trying to figure out what caused the pipe to fall over. And one, as I was saying before, was Mr. Gary Thompson was the only person up there when this happened. Was he purposely trying to do something at the top of the pipe before he started to spray, which resulted in sufficient force to break the pipe at the bottom, accepting Mr. Clouser's opinion that you needed 250 pounds? Or did he slip? And one of the reasons he might have slipped was the fact that, in Mr. Clouser's opinion, there were small holes at the bottom that were allowing the slurry to flow out and make the surface slippery. So that seemed to be, she didn't accept the clog issue because he said he wasn't doing it. There was nobody else that saw what he was doing up there. And we had all this kind of deposition testimony from the mulch defendants about, well, how would you clear it? The one area where actually the issue of the clogging was somewhat relevant, even putting aside comparative negligence, was because they had to open it up and take parts off in order to clear clogs, the people doing that would have seen the top of the pipe to see whether or not there was corrosion in the pipe. So there was some relevancy apart from comparative negligence about the fact that you would have to do some disassembly in order to clear it.
Well, the reason I'm asking these questions is because, if I'm not mistaken, the trial court seemed to think that all this testimony about clogs and trying to clear out clogs was part of what made the whole thing confusing for the jury because, and again, I'm not sure I understand it, but yeah. if the clog issue related to comparative negligence and if comparative negligence was taken out of the case, then the jury would be left with, well, what was all this stuff we heard and what are we supposed to do with that information in assessing what to do in terms of liability?
In a lot of trials, extraneous information does come in, and a lot of testimony is made extraneous by the judge's decisions on motions for directed verdict at the conclusion.
Okay, well, maybe I should do it a different way. When the trial court said comparative negligence is out of the case, did the court tell the jury, you know, basically all the stuff you heard about A, B, and C, you don't have to worry about anymore because that goes to comparative negligence?
Not so specifically that was out of the case.
Well, now I need some clarification in case I've misunderstood the evidence. It seems to me this, like many cases, there's factual evidence that's introduced that can be relevant to more than one legal issue. And here, the issue of clogging, to the extent it was an issue, could arguably apply to a comparative negligence finding or a comparative negligence legal conclusion, mm-hmm. but it also could apply to the superseding intervening cause or whether or not Rainco had negligently manufactured or designed the machinery itself. So it's one of those classic situations where the jury, without an instruction to disregard facts for one purpose, would have to otherwise parse the facts and apply it to more than one legal purpose. And the only thing the trial judge did was say, you may think that this evidence at one point may have been relevant to comparative negligence, but it is no longer relevant to that legal issue.
I don't think, and I'd have to go back and double check, but I don't think she ever came out and said, disregard evidence concerning clogging as it relates
to... No, I understand she didn't, but when she said comparative negligence is no longer in the case, apparently she was relying on the jury to be able to parse that and only apply evidence of clogging to the legal issues that did remain in the case, but not apply it to the legal issue that's out of the case.
And I read through my argument, and I don't even believe I raised clogging and clearing cloggings as evidence of abuse by the employer for superseding intervening cause. I think I stayed away from clogs completely.
But as a matter of jury fact-finding and applying the facts to the law, there's nothing unusual about that,
no.
is there?
And that's our position, and this court ruled in the Firestone case, which I think was even more an extreme case, in that the issue came up, was allowed in despite the fact that it really didn't appear to be in the case regarding some other design feature, and then came out of the case on a directed verdict. And it really didn't relate to anything else. And the court said, or this court said, that that was not a basis for a new trial. The fact that evidence comes in, it comes in for various purposes. But our concern as a defendant, and as we've stated, is that if any time a defendant goes to trial and says, well, I've got a weak comparative negligence case, but the jury should hear it, if we put the evidence in, there's a directed verdict by the plaintiff, the court agrees with the plaintiff and says you haven't put in enough evidence or the inferences you're trying to draw from that evidence are not reasonable inferences and direct the comparative negligence isn't an issue, then arguably every jury potentially is confused. And that's not been my experience in trying cases. And it sort of runs the same way for defendants as in the Firestone case. If a plaintiff comes in and puts forward a number of theories, and on direct verdict, the trial judge dismisses, say, 3 out of 5 and lets the jury hear 2 theories of liability, any defendant can say, well, this is confusing. The jury didn't know that they weren't supposed to consider this, that, or the other thing. And it's just not been the practice in the way that cases have been tried. And the last issue was the business about Mr. Clauser went beyond the testimony in his report. In his report, he indicated that there was, as I said, the disassembly at the top of the standing pipe, and people would have seen whether there was any corrosion inside. And because the deck had been replaced, he made what would appear to be a logical conclusion that the bolts holding the upright to the deck had been unbolted, and somebody would have been able to look at the bottom of that pipe that failed when they did so. And Mr. Mark Thompson, the owner, says he hired somebody else to do it. He didn't know what, he didn't know, he wasn't there, he wasn't sure. And then when he testified at trial, he said what they did was they cut a hole in the new piece of decking and just dropped it right over the top. And I had Mr. Reinecker testify that the pipe had been moved. It was not in the location on the blueprints. And then Mr. Clouser said you couldn't physically put the plate in and still have it welded all the way around to the disc at the bottom. And then in looking at the blueprints, they found where it had been cut and then rewelded underneath. And his testimony did go because he was talking about the pipe underneath. But the only reason he had to do that was because Mark Thompson had sort of thrown in this red, well, it wasn't a red herring. It may have very well been factually correct, but it hadn't disclosed it during his deposition. And our position was, all he said was, since the lower pipe was lower than the upright, and this was corrosion, not erosion, that the lower pipe, because anything that's in the pipe when they turn it off is going to at least drain back through there, is subject to the same forces of corrosion, and anybody looking would have seen it. And then the excerpt from one of the conferences that's in the reply, the answering brief, the judge seemed to be thinking that we were responsible to show which employee was responsible for looking in the pipe and things like that. And our point was the employer has a duty to provide a safe workplace for its employees. And we went on to discuss the restatement and whether or not what happens if an independent contractor fails to do that. Does the employer still have that responsibility? And we never really developed it any further than at that conference. I'd reserve some time for rebuttal.
Good morning. Chief Justice Steele, members of the court, may it please the court, Shaku Baya for Gary Thompson, appellee and plaintiff below. The issue is whether the trial judge abused her discretion when she granted Mr. Thompson's motion for new trial in light of the prejudice caused by the multiple rulings and testimony regarding clogs, the piecemeal testimony regarding the issue of clogs, the failure to grant plaintiff's motion for directive verdict on superseding cause, and Mr. Clouser's testimony, which you just heard about. It is well settled that the abuse of discretion has been defined as those decisions that have been made arbitrarily, capriciously, or without reason. A review of the case law suggests the following pattern. This court will reverse a trial court's finding on a motion for new trial only and only if, one, there was no supporting reasons found in Story versus Camper and its progeny. Two, if the issue at hand is inherently in the belongs to the jury, in the province of the jury, in the case of Lang versus Moran and the issue of agency. And three, if a mistake was made at trial by the trial judge, which is not deemed harmless. You will recall in Burgess versus Hickok, there was the trial judge had a material misunderstanding of the medical injuries of the case, whereby affecting the ruling on plaintiff's failure to prove causation. This court ruled that because the trial judge had a material misunderstanding, that the trial judge's denial of a new trial had to be reversed and a new trial was needed. In Culver versus Bennett, this court said because the lower court gave an improper instruction on proximate cause, a confusing instruction combining but-for and substantial factor together, that needed to be reversed. In the case of Peters versus Gell, which did not appear before this court, it was affirmed by this court where the trial judge permitted medical testimony, an expert testimony that later turned out to be unqualified, and the trial judge said, that was wrong to do, we need a new trial.
Is it correct that the motion for directed verdict on the issue of comparative negligence was made for the first time at the conclusion of all the evidence in the
That's
case?
That's correct. That was a mistake in our briefing, and I apologize.
Well, that wasn't my point. Okay. My point was that the jury had heard all of the evidence about clogging and any other evidence that might relate to comparative negligence or any other issue in the case at the time it was taken from them.
That's correct. It was at the close of the evidence and before closing argument.
So then it would have been incumbent upon the instructions and any special interrogatories to make it perfectly clear to the jury that they were not to consider comparative negligence, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. And I did pull, though it's not in the right, I did pull in the, when she charged the jury about the comparative negligence, she said, she told them, I have ruled as a matter of law that the comparative negligence claim is out of the case. In other words, there is no issue for you to decide about whether or not Mr. Thompson was negligent in his own right. I have ruled as a matter of law that he's not, and that was it.
What is the guidance that you would have us give to a trial judge to decide whether or not a jury is confused? Jury confusion is a basis for a new trial, in your view, correct?
If the confusion it results in prejudice in that a fair deliberation was not carried out, yes.
All right. So how does a trial judge decide if a jury is confused?
Well, the easiest way for a trial judge to decide is if there are several notes that are coming from the jury that are inconsistent, you know, the questions are inconsistent. That is empirical data that would exist to show jury confusion. But that doesn't happen.
Well, there's another way, too, isn't there? Is that the judge were to review on a post-trial motion the instructions that she gave and conclude that, oops, you know, in the heat of the moment, which is unfortunately my recollection of how almost all instructions are formulated, while the jury's waiting, anxious to get the case, you're trying to push together the instructions. If she were to conclude post-trial that her instructions were confusing in some way to the jury, she could conclude that they had been confused by the instructions regardless of the evidence, correct?
That's true. And
was there anything confusing about the instructions in this case?
We submit the superseding cause instruction was confusing because when she took out the comparative negligence defense, we had – pursuant to our motion for directed verdict on that, she did not do that for the superseding cause. So it is our position that all this talk about clogs, the procedure to remove clogs, maintenance to prevent clogs, because the theory was that the Martin didn't maintain, you know, one of them didn't maintain the equipment properly, and that was a superseding cause of the failure of them to find out about the pipe. And by keeping that in there, it permitted someone, we believe, that in doing deliberations to mention, well, you know, we heard all this testimony about clogs that would exist in the hydro receiver, how you go about in removing it, and the maintenance issues on it. And because there wasn't a direct instruction saying all that is out, because clogs, let's say there was a clog there, it did not cause the pipe to fracture, to break.
But
both experts said that.
The superseding cause relates to the issue of proximate cause.
Correct.
And that is in interrogatory number 3, isn't it?
Correct.
So in answering interrogatory number 1, there's no issue of superseding cause or even proximate cause.
The assumption is that the jury is not evaluating the testimony in whole about the clogs. The judge, within her discretion, felt at the end that the way that the testimony went in and evidence went in, that it provided the jury with irrelevant and prejudicial testimony when determining the issue of negligence. And so it was never given, the jury was never given the opportunity to have proper deliberations because of improper inferences that were made during the trial.
Well, I'm confused. Maybe I misunderstood Justice Risley's question. But if the intervening cause goes to proximate cause, why should we be concerned about the fact that the jury found that Rainco was not negligent in the first instance? Because you don't go to the next step of figuring out what was the proximate cause of the accident, because if Rainco is not negligent, they're into the lesson as far as Rainco is concerned. So why would the intervening cause as it relates to proximate cause be an issue at all?
it because of the because we believe and as the judge believed that the way that the testimony went in, and she's in a unique position to observe the testimony, hear the testimony, that it tainted the process in deliberation from answering number one question. That's only part of it.
What was your allegation of negligence against Renko? Was it negligent design?
It was a negligent selection of a pipe they used. It was called a 40 versus stainless steel, the thinnest type pipe, and two, negligent design in terms of they did not have a gusset. They knew at the bottom of the spray boom pipe, the weakest point, an internal corrosion would cause the walls to thin, and then it would break.
And this all relates to equipment that was 27 years old?
That's correct. And nothing to do with the roll of clogs.
And how long should they have designed it to last?
They should have, we submitted that they should have, they had a very detailed manual, owner's manual, that talked about when certain parts were to be repaired, removed, replaced, and nothing was mentioned about the spray boom pipe. In fact, they even talked about clogs in the manual, how to deal with it when something clogged up.
So the question before the jury was, did they negligently design something 27 years ago and compound their problem by having a poor maintenance plan, or did the people who were operating this 27-year-old machine not maintain it properly? Was that the issue before the jury, in part?
In part, yes, because the comparative negligence count was removed. But
well, no, comparative negligence would be different than maintenance, because the operator had nothing to do with the responsibility for maintaining it. He was simply an employee. So we really have three dynamics here. We've got the manufacturer, we've got the employer and maintenance, and we have operation by the employee.
The confusion arises when we look at the testimony as to maintenance, because when there was testimony in maintenance, when you look at Les Mahan's testimony, which was the first time the matter of really clogs came up, one of the earlier witnesses, which we objected to immediately, and I even asked the judge to remove the jury because I didn't want them to hear anything about, in case they could hear in sidebar. And I forewarned her that this is going to cause confusion. And in the end, she found that. But in Mr. Mahan's testimony, he was asked questions by Reinko's counsel that what is the procedure for maintenance and removing clogs. So the impression was given to the jury that the theory was that Mr. Thompson was trying to unplug a clog while, right moments before the pipe broke and propelled him off, causing him to land on his heels, crushing his heels. That is what the jury heard.
Well, but they were told to disregard that because it was no longer an issue in the case, correct?
They were told to disregard the comparative right, about whatever Mr. Thompson was doing.
Well, then why shouldn't we assume they followed that instruction and then just simply address negligent manufacture or design by Renko?
Because it is because the trial court felt with her discretion that the testimony about clogs was the fact that the clog could have been there that caused the fracture, and there was no scientific basis for that.
Well, then I'll ask you the same question I asked before. What do we consider? The feelings of the trial judge about how she viewed the evidence, or the fact of her ruling and her instruction to the jury? What trumps what?
It is, we all know that the trial court has inherent authority to grant a new trial. But it's tempered by the trial judge giving deference to the jury. What trumps what? That is a very good question. And I have spent time thinking about that, and my response is that of an institutional response. We have the institution of a civil jury system to engage in a meaningful, rational, thoughtful process of deliberation. The trial court has a duty to protect that integrity of the trial process, which includes making sure that the duty of the jury to participate in intelligent and meaningful deliberations. Now, the trial judge, in her unique position of being there, of hearing the testimony, watching the evidence, watching the demeanor, is given due deference according to the precedent of this court, that in her unique position, it's more than gut, because she gives supporting reasons of why she felt there was a prejudicial testimony.
Well, help me out and tell me, so far your explanation has really been excellent, whether I ultimately agree with you or not. It's very thoughtful, and I appreciate it. But what were the reasons rather than the feelings that
the reason,
prompted her decision?
The reasons, one, that the introduction of irrelevant and prejudicial testimony on the clog issue and the piecemeal testimony as to the clogs in terms of removal of the clogs. The scattered testimony in and out about the maintenance of the machine in terms of clogs. It's intertwined. What would have been better is that there should have been a curative instruction.
Well, help us understand how you envision the next trial. Let's suppose you prevail and there's a next trial. I assume you would take the view that comparative negligence is out of the case. So the only issue in the case is negligence. And the defense, in part, is going to be, we designed it properly, and alternatively, you didn't maintain it correctly. So when they want to talk about improper maintenance, are they allowed to talk about maintaining it in view of clogging, or is it your opinion that clogging is out of the case, even with regard to maintenance?
Clogging is outside the case, even with regard to maintenance, because where the fracture occurred, they should know history of clogging problems, so it's irrelevant.
Even though the manual refers to the possibility that there may be clogging problems, maybe there is no history, but there could be one.
Correct, and in different parts of the hydroseeder, their clogs would develop in the jets in particular. And the motion, I would file a motion limine in the next trial to answer Justice Holland's question, to make it very clear, to ask the court's direction on what in what specific context then will the use of clogs be mentioned.
So in effect, you'd ask for the curative instruction that wasn't given in this case, but was it asked for?
It was not asked for. I will tell you in all due candor that I thought that the trial judge, when she was going to give the instruction about comparative negligence no longer being the case, was going to explain it further about what you heard about whether there was a clog or not at the time, whether he was unplugging the clog is not an issue anymore. It's not there.
When she did not, did you ask her to?
No, we did not.
Did you take an exception to the instruction for failure to do so?
No, we did not. And in hindsight, you know, I it would have been better to have a Firestone type of jury instruction, but even if that curative instruction, excuse me, was provided, it doesn't necessarily mean that the deliberations would have been, you know, rational and without irrelevant and prejudicial testimony, because we don't know what would have happened then without that instruction, what if there would be any questions coming. We just don't know how that would play out when that instruction is given. That may have caused questions during the deliberation process. Another area where the trial judge, she did state that it's not, we submit that in the test of reviewing the lower court's findings, conclusions, and granting the motion for a new trial, is not what appears to be feelings. It's not feelings. It's very logical and rational thought as outlined in her decision. She goes in great detail to explain why she felt that justice was not served. She gives reasons. She gives explanation. It is our position that the that is all that she needs to do. Now, if this, and unless you find those reasons pretext for, you know, something legally done incorrectly, the deference is great to be given to the trial judge, but at the same time, there's a one needs to preserve the jury verdict, the jury system. What we are concerned with is that in preserving the jury system, the trial jury, what they did is that we must make sure they don't get tainted information so they can engage in a thoughtful and meaningful process and the integrity can be maintained. We submit the integrity was challenged in the way the testimony went in. So when you need to answer your question, when you have to choose who trumps whom, in this case, we submit the trial judge trumps what the jury did, because what she's protecting is the system, the deliberation, the integrity of the process. She's the guardian of justice.
The role of instructions at the conclusion of the case, as well as curative instructions that are given during the course of the case, is to make sure that the jury understands its role and neatly parses the extent to which evidence is applied to certain issues of law. If we look at the instructions and conclude that the instructions are not defective, and we assume that the jury has followed the instructions, and there's nothing on the face of their response to the instructions that indicates otherwise, what role does that play in the weighing process that you've just described?
In answering that question, I turn to, for guidance, Larimore versus Homeopathic, a case of Judge Stifel ruled where there, if you recall, in that case, there was a new trial granted on damages only because it was deemed that the verdict was excessive as to the misapplication of prescription of medication. And the testimony that went in was he was given medication a certain day, and then several days later he died. And the jury gave, at that time, a pretty high number, according to Judge Stifel, and he felt that the jury was confused about what that medicine did. Did it actually kill him? Did it make things worse? And it didn't. There was no testimony for that. There were no, from the case, there were no jury questions, questions from the jury. There were no confusing jury instructions. Judge Stifel felt by being present there, hearing the testimony, looking temporally how the testimony went in terms of when the medication was given and when he died, the jury must have been confused about what harm the medicine caused. And we submit that's the same thing the trial judge is wrestling with, is all that information about what was he unplugging a clog and then the pipe blew up and then so the pipe fractured and then he got injured. That's the question. Temporally is the same thing, and the judge is saying, I don't think they got it. They misunderstood it. And they misunderstood it because of how the testimony went in. No different how Judge Stifel said that the trial jury misunderstood it. And finally, then Judge Quillen, in Ellis versus Scheidt, he does, in that case, a new trial was not granted, but he went out of his way to say that there are circumstances when a trial judge should grant a new trial. And it was arguably dicta. It wasn't arguably. He said that in this case, there's no unusual independent ground to intrude on a jury's judgment, such as atmosphere of trial, or evidence that viewed in retrospect was unduly prejudicial. Ellis versus Scheidt was not appealed on that issue there. And Ellis versus Scheidt, Judge Quillen is giving direction to trial judges that there could be a time, and it should not be often, but there could be a time when viewed in retrospect, the evidence was unduly prejudicial. And that's what we submit happened here. And the trial judge honored her duty. She was true to her duty to say, we cannot prevent this injustice from happening. I'm going to have to fix it. And the only way to fix it is to give a new trial.
Well, I know you've taken the position that the clogging evidence was, in essence, representative of what was confusing and that it didn't apply to any other legal issue. But let's assume for a moment that you've got a situation, arguably here, where the evidence of clogging is what you claim is prejudicial and therefore tainted the verdict. But the jury was told, don't apply those facts to the issue of comparative negligence. It's out of the case. But that evidence is arguably relevant to a legal issue that remains in the case. How do you then say that it was unduly prejudicial because it applied to something that the judge said was out of the case and they were instructed not to consider it for that purpose, yet it remains in the case because it applies to an issue that does, a legal issue that does remain in the case?
The clogging issue is not, at least it's really not part of the superseding cause. Because the clogging caused the problem. And what they were, all the testimony was, what's the procedure to remove the clogs? Implying Mr. Thompson did not follow the proper procedure while he was removing the clogs, which perhaps aggravated the pipe to break. That's how the evidence went in. To be heard by the jury, and that's what the trial judge was getting concerned with. It said she permitted the clogging testimony and only for one purpose, to show that Mr. Thompson was on the platform. That was it. That's what she said. That's the purpose, because the fact that there was the clog did not go to the proximate cause for causing the pipe to fracture. It was a red herring. That became confusing and prejudicial. And then when
Does the record reflect the clog was in a different part of the pipe? That the clog wasn't even where there was the liquid was coming from. Is that correct?
In fact, there was, exactly. There was no clog. Mr. Thompson's testimony was that he was just waiting for the mixture to mix so he could start spraying. He wasn't even touching the pipe.
Well, she could have done but did not instruct the jury to disregard the facts about clogging in its entirety for any purpose. She was not asked to do that. She did not do that.
That's your correct, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
In researching, Larimore is probably the case that comes closest. I would agree with plaintiff's counsel on that because there weren't confusing jury instructions. There weren't confusing notes. There were no inconsistencies in the juror questionnaire.
Well, Mr. Caddy, if there's a new trial, what's the relevance of clogging going to be at the next trial?
It would only become relevant if we can't find Mr. Wilson to redepose him or have him at trial, because the problem with the clogging comes in. Mr. Wilson was working on the truck with the plaintiff at the time of the incident. The plaintiff says he was driving the truck. Mr. Wilson says, I was pulling the hose out to go do some local spraying, and it was clogged.
So your position
so
is
we don't know.
Clogging has nothing to do with maintenance or the pipe breaking. Clogging is simply relevant to the purpose that the plaintiff was on the platform.
It could be relevant for that. It also has relevance, and this may not be important if we retry the case, as giving the employer an opportunity to see the condition of the top of the pipe when clogs are being cleared. I mean, if there were a stipulation that at various times the knuckle was removed and employees could see the top of the pipe, that might remove the issue of whether or not the cloggings had to be mentioned, because that's how it comes in. We do disassembly, we look in, we have the opportunity to look in and see what the condition is. But Did a clog cause the pipe to fail at that instant? From what I understand about the engineering experts, no, a clog did not cause the pipe to fail at that instant. But it might have relevancy to other issues, such as why wasn't the pipe inspected and things of that nature, which go to the superseding cause. The Larimore case is unique. And it goes back to, I think, the first question I was asked, that apparently plaintiff's counsel, during closing arguments, made arguments that the misapplication of the medication orally instead of by injection hastened the death or made the period of time the individual was living more difficult, sort of destroyed his morale. And that was part of the reason why. And that's a unique situation because, as I said, I did not argue anything about clogs, even if as it related to superseding cause. It wasn't ignored and wasn't bypassed. It really comes down, this was a fight between experts. Mr. Kohlberg was basically a consumer products person, a mechanical engineer, small products like mousetraps up to some larger household type equipment. Mr. Clouser was a metallurgist, and it came down to really the jury concluding that his opinion was better. And it goes, I think, the belly. The pipe had a little belly in it, indicating that this pipe was leaning over before it failed, that it was leaking at the bottom, and that this was the last day they were ever going to use this machine before they sold it. They tried to squeak it through. Unfortunately, it failed, and the plaintiff was injured. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. We'll recess and take the case under advisement.
Please rise.